I try not to come more than once a week. He patted his abdominal region, which was flat. Everything in moderation.
I wouldn't have guessed you for a Skyline fan, Liz said. We have to make sure visitors try it, but usually people who didn't grow up in Cincinnati don't like it.
Darcy's expression was haughty. I believe we've established that there's a lot you don't know about me. Nodding once at Willie, Darcy said, Enjoy. A moment later, he was gone. Chapter 34. On most nights after dinner, Mrs. Bennet and varying combinations of her daughters gathered in the den behind the first floor staircase to watch television. On this particular night, the family matriarch was joined by Liz, Mary, and also Aunt Margot. Jane had gone to Chip's apartment, and Kitty and Lydia were at a birthday party for one of the members of their gym. The cake, Liz had not been able to resist asking, would be made with almond flour and coconut oil frosting. Just as some people enjoy knitting in front of the television, Mrs. Bennet was fond of perusing houseware catalogs. Indeed, the sound of pages turning, that quick flap when no item caught her eye, and the pauses when something did, the occasional businesslike lick of the index finger, was one of the essential sounds of Liz's childhood. This habit was also, apparently, what allowed Mrs. Bennet to maintain a belief that she had not actually watched a wide variety of shows, even though she had been in the room for the duration of entire episodes, and in some cases, entire seasons. They were midway through a reality cooking show when Willie popped his head into the room. He said, I was wondering, Liz, if you'd like to go for a walk.
Me?
It seems like a nice night.
Liz was slouched on the floor, her back against an ottoman, and she glanced over her shoulder first at her mother, then at Aunt Margot. How irritating, Liz thought, that rather than fulfilling her obligation to Willie, giving him a tour had instead made him see her as his special pal.
Liz and Jane run in the morning, Mrs. Bennet said. You should go with them tomorrow, Willie.
Running with three people is kind of awkward, Liz said, then immediately felt mean. But we can go for a quick walk. Want to come, Mary?
Unapologetically, Mary shook her head. Liz feared that Willie wanted to bring up the conversation they'd had about the prostitute. Perhaps he wished for further reassurance that she wouldn't repeat it. But once they got outside, he seemed to have no particular agenda.
I hope you're not bored being here, she said as they turned left on Grandin Road. I'm afraid Cincinnati is better to live in than visit.
I can see that, Willie said. And since he was simply agreeing with her, Liz tried not to again feel offended. I need to do some work tomorrow, and I wonder if there's a cafe you recommend. Your parents' bandwidth is a joke.
There's a place called Awakenings on Hyde Park Square.
The heat of the day had dissipated, and it was actually pleasant to be outside. Around them, invisibly, cicadas buzzed. She said,
The summer I graduated from college, I was back here for a few months before I moved in with Jane in New York. Mary and I played 20 questions one time when we were waiting for takeout at a Chinese restaurant. This was before any of us had cell phones. Anyway, I was guessing, and it was a person who lived in Cincinnati. I got to the 20th question and still didn't know who it was, and I'm good at 20 questions.
Liz laughed a little at her own impulse to brag about something unimpressive, and Willie didn't.
Mary told me it was me, Liz continued. I was the person she was thinking of, but I hadn't guessed myself. And I was all outraged, like, I don't live in Cincinnati, I live in New York. She said, you could have fooled me.
Liz and Willie were passing a miniature chateau. Even in its modified version, it was 7,000 or 8,000 square feet, and Liz said,
I guess I'm a Cincinnati opportunist. In New York, I play the wholesome Midwesterner card, but when I'm back here, I consider myself to be a chic outsider. Even before Willie replied, Liz felt the loneliness of having confided something true in a person who didn't care. Still, when he spoke, it was more disappointing than she'd expected. He said, "That chili we had? I liked it okay, but I keep burping up the taste of it." "That happens to everyone," Liz said. "It's called repeating on you." Chapter 35. Neither Liz nor Jane carried their phones on their morning run, so Liz didn't receive the text from Jasper until after she'd eaten breakfast and gone upstairs to shower.
"I had a great idea. Call me,"
read the first, followed by a second.
"Don't you want to know why I'm a genius?"
She walked into the bathroom and sat on the edge of the tub, still in her perspiration-ridden tank top and shorts. Jasper answered on the second ring.
"Cincinnati is like the world headquarters of squash, right?"
he said without prior greeting.
"The sport, not the food."
"Yep, I was with you."
"They send an insane number of kids to play in Ivy League schools every year. But why Cincinnati?"
"Good question," Liz said.
"Don't you think it's crying out for an article?"
In under 2 seconds, Liz thought, "But I need to write the next Women Who Dare as soon as I finish my asking for a raise piece." Then thought, "But it would be fun and random to report an article in Cincinnati." Then thought, "And since I've barely written about sports, that could be a cool challenge." Growing up, she hadn't played squash herself, but had known kids at Seven Hills who did.
Jasper said, "Mainly, though, it'll give me an excuse to come out there and bang you in a hotel room that I get to expense. Win-win-win, right?"
"Oh," Liz said. "Right." Already it seemed a bit embarrassing that she'd imagined he wanted to assign the piece to her rather than himself.
"Plus, I can drop by for one of the famous Bennett family dinners," Jasper said, "and see your ancestral home."
Years earlier, Jasper had met Mr. and Mrs. Bennett and an adolescent, Kitty and Lydia, on a trip they'd made to New York for the lighting of the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center. To Liz's alarm, 14-year-old Kitty had seemed more interested in finding out from her older sisters how one procured a prescription for the pill than in seeing the Rockettes. Lydia, who was still comparatively innocent, was focused on acquiring underwear from Bloomingdale's that said Bloomies across the back. As had happened often with Jasper over the years, the experience of introducing him to her family at brunch had felt to Liz like an enticing yet unsatisfactory facsimile. "Here's the guy who's almost my boyfriend." That hadn't been what she'd said, of course, and to her mother's prying questions, she'd insisted that Jasper was simply a friend. On the phone, she said, "Well, you could have dropped in for a family dinner before sending me skanky lingerie."
"You gotta get over that, Nin," Jasper said. "Have you ever heard of a kid named Cheng Zhou?"
"No."
"He's a prodigy. This 11-year-old kid of Chinese immigrants who's racking up insane squash titles."
"Interesting. I mainly associate the sport with rich white people."
"See?" Jasper said. "I already know more about your hometown than you do."
Chapter 36. Liz entered her father's study. "Do you think Mom has a shopping addiction?"
"Without question."
From behind his desk, her father's tone was equanimous.
"I'm not kidding," Liz said.
"Nor am I."
"Do you think anything should be done about it?"
"Like what?"
"I don't know. Like having her see a shrink?"
"Do you imagine your mother would consent to such a thing?"
Liz sighed and folded her arms. Years before Jane's embrace of yoga,
Had her father quietly achieved some Zen state that buffered him from the disturbances of daily life? Or was it just that he couldn't be bothered to exert himself, so bored was he by his family members' shortcomings?
Aunt Margot's voice became audible from the first floor.
Fred, what happened to the mirror of mummies that used to hang in the dining room?
Leave and shut the door behind you, Mr. Bennett hissed. Quick. Tell her you don't know where I am.
Chapter 37. At the last minute, Jane had asked Chip if Cousin Willie could be included in his dinner party. Willie and Aunt Margot were returning to California the next morning, and Liz suspected that Jane felt guilty for hardly having spent time with him. Chip lived on the 8th floor of a recently completed building in Oakley, not far from Skyline Chili. Its decor, Liz thought upon entry, was so much like that of an upscale airport hotel, geometric patterned carpet, inoffensive prints hanging from the wall, sleek and not particularly comfortable-looking sofas and chairs, that she wondered if he had rented it furnished.
"Come in, come in,"
Chip said as he greeted Liz by kissing her cheek. And there was something downright brother-in-law-ish about the gesture. Then he heartily shook Willie's hand.
"Thrilled you could make it,"
Chip said to Willie. And Liz liked Chip in this moment the most she ever had.
"Can I get you drinks?" Chip said. "Caroline made some of her signature sangria, and don't be deceived by the sweetness. It's lethal."
"Some people say the same about Caroline herself," Liz murmured to Jane. Noting Jane's perturbed expression, Liz added, "Sorry." In the dining room, a glass table was set for 9. 2 places shared the head, presumably reflecting the addition of Willie, and from a bar assembled atop a credenza, Caroline was handing drinks to Charlotte Lucas, as well as to Keith, the other new emergency room doctor Liz had met at the Lucas's barbecue, and to an attractive woman, also black, whom Liz guessed to be Keith's San Diego-dwelling fiancée. This supposition was confirmed with introductions, during which, through a closed sliding glass door that led to a small concrete balcony, Liz made unexpected and forceful eye contact with Fitzwilliam Darcy. Darcy's back was to the street below. His elbows balanced on the balcony railing and a glass of sangria in his right hand. He looked, Liz thought, like a model in a local department store newspaper insert. Handsome, yes, but moody in a rather preposterous and unnecessary way. Neither of them smiled, nor did either of them immediately look away. She realized he was on the balcony alone. What a strange man he was. Something, though she couldn't have said whether it was a compassionate impulse to rescue a person standing by himself at a party, or an urge with a more antagonistic origin, impelled her toward him. She opened the sliding door and stepped outside. The balcony's only furniture consisted of 2 slender black wrought iron chairs. "Are you enjoying the refreshing summer evening?" she asked. Though it was after 7 o'clock, it was still thickly humid. Darcy blinked at her, and she added, "Believe it or not, there's something I've always liked about summer in the Midwest. I even like the sound of the cicadas."
Darcy took a sip of sangria. "Of course you do."
"Here's a nugget about Cincinnati for you," Liz said. "We produce a weirdly disproportionate number of champion squash players. Did you know that?"
"Yes," Darcy said. "I did."
"Really?"
She looked at him quizzically. "I played squash at boarding school."
Unable to restrain a smirk, Liz said, "Of course you did. What boarding school did you go to?"
"It's called Exeter."
With some pique, Liz said, "Yes, I've heard of it. And then where'd you go to college?" After a pause, he said,
"I went to college back in the Bay Area.
Berkeley?
Stanford.
Stanford.
I've never understood why people do that, Liz said. Like, I went to college in New Haven, or I went to college in Boston. Do you think if you reveal your elite education, I'll be so intimidated that I'll faint?
Darcy shrugged. It seems less pretentious.
It's more pretentious. You know what? I can handle your Stanford degree. I went to Barnard. And you know what else? I've lived for the last 20 years in New York, and so has Jane.
Yes, you mentioned that at Charlotte's, Darcy said calmly. During the same conversation when we discussed mascara sending you to Saudi Arabia, where you wore an abaya and a headscarf.
His recall was somewhat unsettling. Oh, Liz said. I guess we did talk about it.
Perhaps you didn't realize I was paying attention.
You know, Liz said, what year did you graduate? I'll bet we're close in age.
I graduated from college in 97.
Then you were in the same class as a good friend of mine. Did you know Jasper Wick?
Yes. Darcy seemed unimpressed by the coincidence.
You don't think that's noteworthy? Liz said.
Not especially.
Really? That here we are in Cincinnati in 2013, and you went to college in California in the mid-90s with basically my closest friend?
That's how socioeconomic stratification works. I'm sure you and I know other people in common, too, though personally, I find the name game tedious.
Well, Liz said, my apologies for boring you.
Darcy didn't say she hadn't bored him. He said nothing.
Jasper's coming to Cincinnati soon to write an article about squash players, Liz said. Maybe you two should have a reunion.
I doubt my schedule will allow it.
Do you not like him or something?
We weren't friends.
Darcy's disinclination to elaborate, his apparent belief that he needn't explain or excuse himself, was enormously irritating. And his eschewal of convention was even more bothersome than it would have been if he were unaware of etiquette, which obviously he was not.
Were you both in love with the same girl? Liz asked.
Caroline mentioned your fondness for interrogation.
Some people think asking questions is friendly and polite. Plus, I'm a journalist.
Maybe the reason you're a journalist is that it gives you a professional justification for being nosy.
Darcy took another sip of sangria, and very briefly, before he licked it off, a trace of purple liquid clung to his lips. Then he said,
"Excuse me,"
bowed his head, and walked inside, leaving Liz alone on the balcony. Chapter 38. Dinner was to be individual pizzas that the guests would prepare to their own liking, with an array of thoughtfully selected toppings. Sun-dried tomatoes, fresh basil, artisanal salami. While Liz appreciated the casually festive menu, it soon became clear that Chip had, by the time of his guest's arrival, not yet made the dough, apparently unaware that it would need to sit for an hour after he'd mixed the ingredients. In addition, his oven could fit no more than 4 pizzas at a time. Thus, it was 10 o'clock when they sat to eat, and half the pizzas were cool. Liz ended up between Willie and Jane. Somehow, on Jane's other side sat Darcy rather than Chip. It was not clear to Liz that she had, in her earlier exchange with Darcy, embarrassed herself, but it also wasn't clear that she hadn't. Thus, she decided to abstain from initiating further conversation with him.
"You look very pretty tonight," Willie said to Liz at one point, and she was just tipsy enough, the sangria was indeed strong, to find the comment endearing rather than weird.
"Thank you, Cousin Willie," she said. "You look very handsome." At the conclusion of the main course, Jane, Liz, and Charlotte cleared the plates,
and when Charlotte and Liz were standing by the kitchen sink, Charlotte said,
"Were you and Darcy flirting on the balcony?"
"Oh, God, no," Liz said. "The opposite. And I'm pretty sure he's dating Caroline."
"Really?"
Charlotte said. "I didn't know that."
At the table, Caroline was on Darcy's other side and had spent most of the meal curled toward him in conversation like a poisonous weed. As a dessert of brownies and Grater's ice cream appeared, Jane murmured to Liz,
"Chip bought me a mountain bike."
She didn't seem pleased.
Liz looked at Jane.
"That was nice of him."
While at the Tudor for dinner, Chip had mentioned that he'd already explored several area trails. Jane shook her head.
"I think it was expensive." "Well, I'm sure he wouldn't have bought it if he couldn't afford it."
"Sorry, Jane, but he's into you."
"Maybe that's the problem,"
Jane said.
"Maybe his expectations are too high."
Liz laughed.
"You think if he gives you a fancy bike, you're obligated to put out? Because if I'm not mistaken, you've been doing that for weeks."
"It just seems soon for such an extravagant present."
"Will you relax and enjoy being courted?" Liz said. "It's not a diamond ring."
"Well, I definitely wouldn't accept that," Jane said.
After a pause, on the other side of the table, Keith, his fiancée, and Chip were discussing a hot appendix Keith had seen the previous day. Jane added,
"You think I should keep the bike?"
"Yes," Liz said.
"Go riding with him. Have fun."
Willie, who had been in the bathroom, rejoined them then and gestured toward a pint of ice cream on the table.
"The famous black raspberry Chip, I take it."
Liz passed the pint to him.
"When in Cincinnati," she said.
In spite of her plan not to initiate conversation with Darcy again, certainly not on this evening and possibly not ever, Chip and all eight of his guests ended up back out on the balcony, and Liz found herself standing just inches from the person she'd sought to avoid. For better or worse, she was someone who filled silences and smiled at strangers. Thus, she said to Darcy,
"How was your pizza?"
"That cicada sound you like so much," Darcy said. "It's the males contracting their abdominal muscles."
The sound was audible at that moment, beneath the simultaneous balcony conversations. She said,
"Did you learn that in medical school?"
He dispensed one of his infrequent smiles. "I just looked it up on Wikipedia. It's a mating call."
"How romantic,"
Liz said.
"For what it's worth, I don't wish Jasper Wick ill," Darcy said. "Everyone should have the right to move on from their past."
Liz looked at him sharply.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"I assume you know he was kicked out of Stanford."
"What?"
Liz thought. She said nothing, and Darcy, who appeared genuinely surprised, added,
"Did you not know that?"
"It actually isn't something we've discussed."
In the shadowy summer night, they watched each other.
"Didn't you say he's your best friend?" Darcy said.
"Why did he get kicked out?"
"I shouldn't speak for him," Darcy said. "But it's not as if it was a secret. It caused a campus-wide stir."
"Was it drugs?"
Liz asked.
"Or cheating on a test?"
Darcy's expression had grown impatient. If an unspoken detente had occurred between them, it was no longer in effect.
"Those are questions for you to ask Jasper," he said.
Chapter 39
"Lizzie, I came to say goodbye," Cousin Willie said. "It's been great to reconnect with you."
Liz was at her desk, writing an email to Kathy DeBerg's publicist, who had ignored Liz's entreaties since her failure to call during Kathy DeBerg's 10-minute window of availability several days before.
"You too,"
Liz said to her cousin. Miraculously, Mary had agreed to drive Aunt Margot and Willie to the airport,
and their imminent departure made Liz generous toward her cousin. Willie stopped just a few feet from Liz's chair. His countenance was serious, and he seemed agitated.
"Is something wrong?" Liz asked.
Instead of speaking, he swiftly bent down and pressed his lips to hers. The surprise of the kiss was exacerbated when it became evident that he did not mean for it to be brief. He proceeded to open his mouth, and with the intrusion of his tongue, Liz pulled back her head in horror.
"Oh, Willie!"
She was shocked, but not entirely. She was appalled, but also amused. She felt already cruel and distant, as if this were a moment she was comically describing to Jane or Jasper rather than currently experiencing. Still, she needed to focus in order to extricate herself with dignity or grace.
"I realize I'm not a prince in a fairy tale," Willie said, "but we get along. We're known quantities to each other. And you're almost 40.
"Jane is almost 40. I'm 38. But Willie, my God, we're cousins."
"Not by blood. It isn't like our kids would face a stigma."
These hypothetical children that she didn't want with any man, least of all Willie, she resented him for conjuring them up.
"Look," Willie said, "you and I are practical people. I've never been able to see the point of roses and chocolates, and I'm guessing you haven't either. But I'll be faithful to you. I'll respect your work, and I know you'll respect mine. I don't want a woman who gives me a hard time about my long hours. I think we owe it to ourselves to give a relationship a try."
"Just out of curiosity," Liz said, "did you come to Cincinnati with the idea of hitting on me?"
"You and I have always been compatible. Margot and your mom both think we make a great couple."
Willie set his hand on her shoulder. Immediately, she lifted it away, stood, and folded her arms.
"We're not a couple," she said. "And if you're under the impression that I want us to be one, you're mistaken."
Softening her tone, she added, "When you meet some awesome woman in a year or two, you'll be so glad you didn't end up with me."
"How can you be certain I'll meet someone when you haven't?"
Ignoring the question's sting, Liz said, "There's a lot you don't know about my life." Willie sighed. He seemed irritated rather than wounded.
"Does the cousin thing bother you that much? Growing up, we hardly spent time together."
"Yes. It does bother me."
"I'm open to giving you a few days to think it over," Willie said. "I'll call you later this week, after I'm back in California."
"No, Willie. And I can tell you now that it's a waste of time to try this with any of my sisters."
Willie set his hands on his hips.
"Do you know how much I'm worth?"
"You need to go."
She would not give him a farewell hug. His obstinacy had become offensive. He looked at her curiously. Perhaps, Liz thought, he was for the first time realizing that she had an identity, an agency other than those he'd invented for her. At last, he said,
"It's funny you think there's such a big difference between being 38 and being 40.
Chapter 40. Jane, who was the first person with whom Liz wished to discuss what had just transpired, was at a yoga class. Jasper was the second person. Except that Liz remained unsettled by the information she'd learned the previous night about his alleged expulsion from Stanford. And so, having barricaded herself in the third-floor bathroom because Cousin Willie was, at least for a few more minutes, still on the tutor's premises, it was to Charlotte Lucas that Liz sent a text while sitting on the tile floor.
"Cousin Willie just kissed me. Eek!"
Less than a minute later, Charlotte's return text pinged.
"Wait, like, kissed, kissed?" "Yes. What's wrong with him? Or me?"
"That's very weird. Willie's cute in a nerd way, but, cousins?"
An additional text from Charlotte arrived a few seconds later. Headed into meeting. Have a drink tonight?
Yes,
Liz wrote back.
Zula? Somewhere else? You name time.
Then she called Jasper. Should I stay at the Cincinnatian or 21C? He asked. Fiona's booking my ticket to Cincinnati right now.
You know how my cousin Willie, the Silicon Valley whiz kid, is visiting?
Liz said.
He just came on to me.
Jasper laughed. Incest is best, huh? You can be like the Egyptian pharaohs.
I'm not joking. He stuck his tongue in my mouth.
Did you like it? Liz hadn't been planning to blurt out what she said next. Somehow, it simply emerged. She said,
You didn't get expelled from Stanford, did you?
There was a long silence, an immediately sour silence, and finally Jasper said, What the fuck? Where's this coming from?
I'm sorry. Until now, Liz really hadn't believed it. She'd imagined Darcy was confusing Jasper with someone else. I shouldn't have... There's this guy here named Fitzwilliam Darcy, and I guess you guys...
Before she could finish, Jasper said, Darcy lives in Cincinnati? What the hell is he doing there?
There's a big stroke center where he's a surgeon.
Jasper laughed bitterly. Of course he is. The dude has had a god complex since he was 20 years old. What a wanker.
Rarely was Jasper this undilutedly aggrieved. Though he was a frequent complainer, his complaints tended to contain some degree of levity, even charm. He said,
I'll bet I never told you that a lot of what went down at Stanford was Darcy's fault.
This was correct, in part because she and Jasper had never spoken of what had gone down at Stanford, period. Liz was sure of it. Indeed, she had always been under the impression that the school and his time there were a kind of emotional lodestar. In addition to his gold Stanford ring, he sometimes, on fall weekends, wore a much-faded red Stanford sweatshirt. He kept in his living room a framed photograph of him with several fraternity brothers, a row of handsome, athletic-looking men children in ties and blue blazers, though it struck Liz for the first time that she had never actually met any of the other people in the photo. New York was crawling with her Barnard classmates. But it had seemed unsurprising that his college friends lived on the West Coast.
I'll tell you the whole saga in Cincinnati, Jasper was saying. It puts me in a bad fucking mood just thinking about it.
You should stay at 21C, Liz said. I've never been, but it's supposed to be very hip.
I hope you're not friends with Darcy, Jasper said. I wouldn't let that dude lick my shoe.
It was a relief to be united rather than divided from Jasper. Don't worry, Liz said. I feel the same way. Chapter 41. The one solace to the unpleasant direction Liz's conversation with Jasper had taken was that it had distracted her from her encounter with Willie. After she'd ended the call, however, that encounter, combined with the confirmation of Jasper's Stanford expulsion, created in her an even higher level of turmoil. Without asking permission and with no particular destination in mind, she left the house in her mother's car. A few minutes later, she was pulling into the parking lot of Rookwood Pavilion with the idea of getting a manicure and pedicure, and she emerged from the salon after more than an hour, also missing 4 inches of hair, with the remainder layered in a way she was almost certain her colleagues at Mascara would be unimpressed by. Lydia and Kitty sat at the kitchen table wearing workout clothes and eating cashews and organic beef jerky. When Liz entered the house through the back door, Lydia said, Did you enter the witness protection program to escape from the lust of Cousin Willie? I like your haircut, Kitty said. You couldn't have pulled that off a few years ago, but your cheekbones are showing more as you get older.
Liz looked at Lydia.
Who told you about Willie?
Mom is flipping her shit,
Lydia said, FYI.
As Lydia spoke, Mrs. Bennett's voice became audible from the other side of the closed swinging door between the kitchen and dining room.
Is that Lizzie? Is Lizzie back?
The door swung into the kitchen, and Mrs. Bennett appeared, flushed and bustling.
Lizzie, what on earth were you thinking? Why, you probably hurt his feelings terribly.
Mom, please don't tell me you think I should date Cousin Willie.
He's smart, he's successful, and it's late in the game for you to be picky. He's your step-cousin, Elizabeth. Don't try to tell me you're related because you aren't.
It's not legal in Ohio to marry your first cousin, Liz said.
During her pedicure, she had checked this information on her phone, hoping to bolster her dismay with facts. She didn't mention that such a marriage actually was legal in California.
So let's say we fell madly in love, which would never happen. If we wanted to make it official, we'd need to hire a lawyer.
That'd be awesome if you went to prison for marrying Willie, Lydia said. I'd laugh so hard.
Is someone else pursuing you? Mrs. Bennett asked.
And her accusatory tone made Liz immediately think of the red teddy.
Because if there is, I'd like to know who.
Chapter 42. Okay, don't kill me, Charlotte said to Liz at Zula. But I was thinking about it, and I can see Willie being a good boyfriend.
Have you ever had a conversation with him?
I talked to him for a while at Chip's dinner party. He was nice.
Putting aside the cousin stuff, which there's no way I can do, he's incredibly pompous. And even though he's smart, he isn't very interesting because he's not interested in other people. In retrospect, I realized that the only questions he asked were when he was evaluating me as girlfriend material.
Charlotte looked carefully at Liz. Are you sure there's no ST between you and Darcy?
I'm totally sure.
ST, an abbreviation the two friends had been using since their high school days, stood for sexual tension. Liz leaned forward.
Although, it turns out Jasper and Darcy went to college together and don't like each other.
She thought of mentioning Jasper's expulsion from Stanford, but without yet knowing the circumstances, she was hesitant. Instead, she said,
Jasper's coming to Cincinnati to write an article about squash. Want to meet him when he's here?
Of course I do. Wait, did you just say he's coming to write an article? Charlotte rolled her eyes.
Please.
Liz laughed.
And because I'm irresistible and he can't stay away from me, she said. Also because of that.
Is he really writing an article? Or is that just the excuse he's giving people? Liz took a sip of wine.
It's both.
Chapter 43. Returning to the tutor at 10 o'clock, Liz saw in the driveway an unfamiliar navy blue SUV, and therefore, knowing she wasn't the last one awake, left the kitchen light on. She'd passed through the dining room and reached the front hall when she heard from the den hushed but unmistakably flirtatious voices that halted just before Lydia appeared in the den's doorway.
Are you suffering from PTSD after Willie kissed you?
Lydia asked.
Probably,
Liz said.
Come in here.
Lydia's tone was uncharacteristically warm.
I'll introduce you to him.
He was, as Liz had discerned from his website, fit and handsome in a rather conventional way. Though when he stood as she entered the room, she saw that he was significantly shorter than she'd have imagined. Ham extended his arm.
Hamilton Ryan. Or Ham, if you prefer. Just like the lunch meat.
Liz Bennett.
One of the New York sisters, if I'm not mistaken, he said.
Not bad, Liz said. There are a lot of us to keep track of.
She gestured to the television screen, which was frozen on the opening credits of a popular cable series about FBI agents, and asked,
Which season?
First season, first episode,
Ham said, and Liz said. Then you guys have a lot to look forward to. Or at least until season 3, when it comes unraveled. Ham, you own a gym?
I do.
Liz thinks CrossFit is culty.
Lydia made air quotes. Good-naturedly, Ham said. It is.
I never said that, Liz protested. It just wasn't for me. Because she tried it once 6 years ago for an article she was writing. I did it more than once, Liz said.
That's right, Ham said. You work for a magazine. That sounds like a cool job.
Depending on the day, Liz said.
Liz, Ham is old like you, Lydia said. He was born in the 70s. Liz and Ham made eye contact and laughed.
I thought you seemed kind of geriatric, Liz said.
What year? 79.
Oh, you're a spring chicken. I was born in 75. You're from Seattle, aren't you?
Ham nodded, and Liz realized that she had just mentioned information she'd learned from her online investigation rather than from Lydia.
So how'd you end up in Cincinnati? Liz asked.
The short version is, I followed an ex here.
That's enough interviewing, Lydia said to Liz. You can leave now.
Both she and Ham were sitting on the couch by this point, their bodies nestled together. Wow, Lydia, Ham said. No mincing words for you, huh?
But he set his arm around her as he spoke. And Liz had the bewildering thought that perhaps Lydia had met a nice, normal, down-to-earth guy. What she'd have in common with such a person was difficult to fathom. Lydia is known in the family for her subtlety, Liz said, and in reply, Lydia raised her middle finger. Nice to meet you, Ham, Liz said. Chapter 44. It was again Liz's turn to drive her father to physical therapy, and no sooner had they pulled out of the driveway of the tutor than Mr. Bennett said,
"The reason your mother wants you to give Cousin Willie a chance is that she thinks his money will save us. Don't listen to her."
"Save you how?"
"It turns out my time in the hospital was frightfully expensive."
"How much?"
"It's hardly your concern, but since you asked, let's see. The surgery was $122,000, not counting the anesthesia. It was $3,000 a day to stay at that elegant five-star hotel known as Christ Hospital. Then there's a little something called a doctor fee, and that was another $7,000. Shall I go on?"
"Isn't most of it covered by health insurance?"
"Your mother and I don't have health insurance. Neither of us has had a serious ailment before now."
"Oh, my God. You don't have health insurance?" Liz was truly astonished. And it occurred to her to pull over, but then what? Nothing would change, and they'd be late for physical therapy.
"Let me be clear," Mr. Bennett said. "If Willie offered to pay all our bills this instant, it wouldn't be incentive enough for you to endure his company."
Despite Liz's growing panic, Mr. Bennett sounded practically nonchalant. "Lydia and Kitty and Mary must not have health insurance either, right?" Liz said. "I always assumed they were on yours." Though as she considered it, she realized that both Mary and Kitty were probably too old for this to be true. As she merged from Dana Avenue onto Interstate 71, Liz said, "Maybe you should take out a mortgage on the house."
"My dear, the house is mortgaged."
"I thought Pop-Pop and Granny sold it to you for a dollar."
"That was 30 years ago, and there are 7 of us in this family. I've indulged your sisters and mother for far too long."
"When did you get the mortgage?"
8 years? 10?
Mr. Bennett invoked the number as neutrally as if he were trying to recall how much time had elapsed since he'd last visited Europe. Do you and Mom have an investment advisor?
I'm our investment advisor.
What does Mr. Meyer do?
Our taxes, and none too adeptly, but we've put up with his incompetence for so long that it seems disloyal to go elsewhere.
Then at least you've been paying taxes?
Through the nose.
How much is your mortgage payment each month? And how much do you have in savings?
You need not worry about that, Lizzie.
Yeah, Mom thinks I should bail out the family by, like, whoring myself to Willie. Just for the sake of argument, if I called him and said I'd changed my mind, then what? Would I say, and by the way, do you mind transferring $100,000 or $400,000, however much it is, into my parents' bank account?
I'm not sure your mother's thought it through that clearly. It's the general proximity to Willie's money that appeals to her.
Is this a plan Mom and Aunt Margot hatched together?
Margot doesn't know about our financial predicament, nor do any of your sisters, and you mustn't mention it to them. I'm in no mood for histrionics. But yes, Margot does like the idea of you and Willie. My protests fell on deaf ears.
So what will you do about the bills?
When you're as old as I am, you know that situations have a way of sorting themselves out.
Wait, when does your Medicare kick in?
On my 65th birthday,
Mr. Bennett said.
It's a shame I didn't think to schedule my myocardial infarction for 6 months from now, isn't it?
Liz sighed. I hate to even suggest this, but you could take out a second mortgage.
We have one.
Again, her father delivered the information matter-of-factly. When she looked across the front seat, he appeared less sheepish than she might have anticipated. Jesus, Dad, she said.
I'd volunteer to have a hitman off me, but our life insurance policies have lapsed, so I'd be of no more use dead than I am living.
There must be someone at the hospital we can talk to, Liz said. There's no way you're the first person to be treated there without insurance. Her father said nothing, and Liz added, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't you basically headed for foreclosure on the house?
Let's not borrow problems.
This is almost making me think I should date Willie.
With certainty, Mr. Bennett said, not even if we become paupers begging in the street.
Chapter 45. According to Jane, Caroline Bingley had at last discovered a sushi restaurant in Cincinnati that met her standards, and had invited Jane to join her there for lunch. Just us two, none of your sisters. Caroline had specified in a text to Jane that morning that Liz had seen while Jane was in the shower, and Liz had tried not to experience the doubly insulting sting of being excluded by a person she didn't care for.
I wonder if she's sniffing you out as a sister-in-law, Liz said as she passed off her father's car keys to Jane.
If Caroline was, Liz thought without true optimism, perhaps Chip could be the one to save the Bennett family from financial ruin.
Although Liz was still rattled by the conversation with her father and didn't realistically see how she could honor his wish to keep its contents private even from Jane, this didn't seem like the moment to repeat them.
I'm pretty sure Caroline just wants to hang out, Jane said.
The sisters' eyes met, and Jane whispered,
Lizzie, he told me last night that he loves me.
Oh, my God, Liz said. I knew it.
Did you say it back?
Jane seemed bashful, but very pleased. She nodded. Still whispering, she said,
it's crazy, right? We've only known each other a few weeks.
Beneath her pleasure for Jane, Liz felt a stab of envy. She and Jasper did not say it after 16 years. Once, more than a decade before, during an overwrought conversation following a few months of not speaking, Jasper had said to her,
I love you in my life.
And she'd replied, I love you in mine. It had been a triumphant and horrible moment, never replicated. Trying to sound lighthearted, Liz said to Jane, "When you know, you know."
Chapter 46. Talia Goldfarb, the executive editor of Mascara, had sent Liz an email that read, "Woman Who Dares?" A link led Liz to an article mentioning the first female Chinese astronaut, apparently known as a taikonaut, and below the link, Talia had written, "Also, how was interview with Kay DeBerg?" After sending yet another email to Kathy DeBerg's publicist, Liz looked up the cost of various medical procedures and calculated that her father's hospital bill was roughly $240,000. The next tasks, she thought, were to find a mortgage statement, to determine how much her parents had in savings, and to make an appointment with someone in Christ Hospital's billing department. She was walking down the steps from her bedroom to the second floor to see if it might be an opportune time to root around in her father's study when her cell phone rang. She hurried back upstairs to where she'd left the phone on her desk, saw that the caller was Jane, and answered by asking, "How was lunch?"
"Oh, Lizzie." Jane's voice was tremulous. "I fainted at the restaurant, and they've brought me to the ER.
Wait! Are you okay? What happened?"
There was a long silence. Then, so quietly Liz almost couldn't hear her, Jane said,
"I'm pregnant."
Chapter 47. Liz had first been made aware of her older sister's exceptional goodness in 1982 when Jane was in second grade and Liz in first. May Fete, which was an annual celebration for the elementary school students at Seven Hills, was to occur on a Friday afternoon early in the month, and Liz was ecstatic with anticipation at the thought of the cakewalk, balloon pop, and goldfish toss. Jane fell ill with chickenpox a full week before the festivities. Due to the length of time necessary for symptoms to develop, it was impossible that she transmitted the virus to Liz, but someone did. And on the day of May Fete itself, Liz was febrile and profoundly itchy. Most of Jane's lesions had healed by then, and since she was back in school, there was no medical reason for her to skip the event. That she did so was entirely voluntary, an act of solidarity that even at the time Liz regarded with wonder. Were the situation reversed, Liz would, without question, have attended May Fete. But Jane was calmly insistent, saying to their befuddled mother,
"If Lizzie is staying home, I am too."
She added,
"Next year we can go together."
That evening, Jane and Liz ate mugs of peppermint ice cream sitting side by side in Liz's bed, while Liz wore white cotton gloves meant to discourage scratching. Then Jane read aloud from Frog and Toad together, and they went to sleep at 8 o'clock. Despite the frenzy of excitement May Fete continued to provoke in Liz for several more years, when she recalled it in adulthood, what she remembered more than any bounce house she'd jumped inside or trinket she'd acquired was the kindness of her sister. Chapter 48. Revelatory as it was, Jane's news had not been shared in a way that invited further questioning. She merely told Liz she had passed out for just a minute or two, and although she was sure that she was fine, the doctors wanted to run a few tests before releasing her. She was at Christ Hospital, she said, and had seen Chip briefly before he got summoned to another patient, but he was not the one treating her. Caroline was still with her, and Liz mustn't tell anyone else in the family.
"I'll be there as fast as I can," Liz said.
It was only upon hanging up that Liz realized she was both alone in the house and without a car. Jane had taken their father's Cadillac to meet Caroline,
Their parents were having lunch at the country club, and their sisters were God knew where. Liz considered texting Mary, Kitty, or Lydia, but decided against it because of their unreliability and indiscretion. She next considered taking a bus, but she was entirely unfamiliar with the routes. And finally, she considered calling a taxi, which was something she had never done in Cincinnati and therefore was uncertain could be accomplished with efficiency. Then, decisively, she changed into running shorts, a sports bra, and a tank top. She laced up her turquoise and orange sneakers, found her sunglasses, grabbed a baseball cap from Kitty's room, chugged a glass of water as she stood by the kitchen sink, and hurried outside. It was just after 1 o'clock and 96 degrees. Christ Hospital was 4.5 miles away, according to the directions on her phone, so she estimated it should take her 35 minutes to get there. Unlike when she ran with Jane, Liz took her phone. She stuck it between her underwear and hip, but even before she reached the street, it fell onto the driveway. So she clutched it, heading west on Grandin Road, which was the same route she took each morning with Jane. She even passed the country club, where, presumably, her parents were midway through their pseudo-healthy Caesar salads. How much, Liz wondered for the first time, were the country club's annual fees? At Madison Road, instead of turning right, she made a left toward O'Brienville, passing the antique stores and clothing boutiques. The air was thick, and the sun felt aggressive, possibly malevolent. So Jane was pregnant. Jane was pregnant. The most immediate question, of course, was whether this development was attributable to the sperm donor or Chip. If it was the sperm donor, Liz thought, Jane would have conceived 8 weeks earlier, in which case, wouldn't she have known? Then Liz recalled Jane's hesitation about Chip, in spite of her obvious attraction to him. Had she known? And her comments about moving to Cincinnati. Those, too, could have been hints at her condition, though it was equally likely she'd want to stay in town in order to raise a child with Chip, or if she was a single mother, to avoid the expense and hassle of New York. Either way, between Chip and an anonymous donor, Liz couldn't say which was preferable. Complications were sure to arise from both. Passing the Gothic Church of St. Francis de Sales, where Liz went south on Woodburn Avenue, she was sweating more than she ever had in her entire life. The potential irony of fainting on the way to see Jane after Jane had fainted didn't escape Liz. And yet, despite the heat and the fatigue in her muscles from already having run that morning, adrenaline kept her focused. A baby. After all this time, Jane was to be the mother of a baby. East McMillan, which was the widest and busiest thoroughfare on Liz's run thus far, there were few pedestrians and many cars, shimmered in the sun. Kitty's baseball cap was royal blue, with a University of Kentucky logo, though UK was a school no one in their family had attended, and Liz wondered if the cap was making her head warmer. Removing it didn't seem to help matters, however, and on the Reading Road overpass, she donned it again. She considered slowing to a walk, but Auburn Avenue wasn't far off, and once she reached it, she was practically there. By the time the enormous brick edifice of Christ Hospital came into view, Liz felt that time had collapsed, and she had been running for several years through a stasis of heat. Behind her sunglasses, perspiration fell into her eyes, making it difficult to see. Glancing at the map on her phone, she followed Auburn Avenue to Mason Street and curved toward Eleanor Place and the entrance of the emergency room. Just outside its automatic door, beneath the porte-cochere, she stopped and bent, setting her hands on her knees to catch her breath.
"Liz?"
said a male voice, and Liz stood up straight. Sweat was dripping from all the usual places, her temples and the back of her neck and her armpits, but also from a range of body parts less commonly associated with thermoregulation, including her kneecaps. She removed her sunglasses to wipe her eyes with the heels of her hands,
and a droplet of sweat flew through the air and landed on the forearm of Fitzwilliam Darcy's white coat. She saw it happen, and she was certain that he did, too. In a tone that fell somewhere between confusion and disapproval, he said, "What are you doing here?" Only at this moment did her choice to run to the hospital appear strange as opposed to merely uncomfortable. It seemed difficult to avoid the truth, though surely the entire truth wasn't necessary. Still breathing unevenly, she said, "Jane fainted, and they brought her to the ER, but I think she's fine. What are you doing here?"
"Seeing a patient. Does Jane have a history of syncope?"
"If that's the same as fainting, then no."
"It is a very hot day, and not the time most people would choose to go running."
"Only mad dogs and Englishmen, I hear," Liz said. "But there were no cars at our house. Do I go through there?"
She gestured toward the automatic door. "I'll go with you," Darcy said. And as they walked inside, he added, "Jane's 39?
"Yes." In spite of the other subjects preoccupying her, Liz couldn't help noting that her sister's age must have been a topic of discussion between Chip and Darcy.
"If she's generally in good health, I suspect it's heat syncope," Darcy said.
They paused at a reception desk, and Darcy said,
"I'm Dr. Fitzwilliam Darcy, and I need to find a patient named Jane Bennett."
The receptionist typed briefly on her keyboard before saying, "Room 108. Neither Liz nor Darcy spoke as they continued walking. At a set of double doors, Darcy held a badge on a lanyard around his neck up to a sensor, and the doors opened toward them. They were in a wide hall and had no sooner rounded a corner than they saw Caroline Bingley, who wore such a peculiar expression. It seemed to be a combination of mirth and fury, but was that even possible? That Liz had the hysterical thought that Jane might have died. "Is she okay?" Liz asked with alarm. Caroline's eyes narrowed. Glaring, she said, "Congratulations, Auntie Liz." Chapter 49. When Liz pulled back the curtain at the entrance to Jane's small room, she saw her sister in a bed whose mattress was set at a semi-reclined angle. Jane wore a hospital gown. Liz hadn't expected the change of clothes, which somehow made Jane's status as a patient official, and a tube inserted into a vein at her left inner elbow delivered clear liquid. Quietly, almost silently, Jane was crying. The sister's eyes met, and Jane brought a tissue to her nose.
"Oh, Lizzie," she said, "what have I done?"
Liz climbed onto the bed beside Jane and set an arm around her. "I stink," Liz said, "just to warn you." Briefly, Jane appeared to forget her distress.
"Did you go to CrossFit?"
"I ran here," Liz said. "There were no cars at home."
"Are you okay?"
Jane's lower lip quivered. "Not to put you on the spot, but is it Chips or from IUI?" A few seconds passed, then Jane shook her head, unable to speak. After another interval of silence, followed by an enormous sniff, Jane said,
"Everything was so chaotic with Dad's surgery. I kept meaning to buy a test to see if the last round at the clinic had worked. Then I met Chip, and we were having such a good time that suddenly it seemed like maybe it'd be better if I wasn't pregnant."
"So it's not Chips," Liz said.
"They're going to do an ultrasound to figure out how far along I am. Anything is possible, I guess, but we've been using condoms."
"Does he know you're pregnant?" Jane sighed.
"At the restaurant, the EMT asked if I could be, and I said maybe, but I didn't mention the donor stuff. Of course, Caroline heard, and she told Chip before I had a chance. I think she called him from her car as I was riding in the ambulance. So he found me, and he was very sweet and worried. I wasn't even sure I was pregnant at that point because they hadn't done the blood test. But I felt like I had to explain to him about the IUI, and he was a little shocked, and then he got called away for a stab wound before we could finish the conversation. That was an hour ago.
Wow, Liz said. Jane wiped her nose with the back of her hand, and Liz stood to pluck a tissue from a box on the nearby counter.
At least I wasn't just stabbed, Jane said. It could be worse.
True, Liz said. But you're still allowed to be upset.
It was so strange at the restaurant, Lizzie. I thought, I never think this. I thought, maybe instead of sushi, I'll order teriyaki. Raw fish seemed disgusting. But Caroline suggested splitting a few rolls, and I said okay. When the food came, I looked at it and just the smell. I was sure I would throw up. Instead, the next thing I knew, I was lying on the floor with a bunch of waiters staring at me.
After procuring the tissue, Liz had perched at the foot of Jane's bed.
So,
Liz hesitated. Do you want to be pregnant?
I did.
Jane's voice quavered.
Before meeting Chip, I wanted it a lot.
Chapter 50. Including the time since Jane's most recent period, the technician who completed the ultrasound placed the pregnancy at between 9 and 10 weeks. Because Jane knew to the hour when the final round of insemination she'd undergone prior to leaving New York had occurred, she could confirm the estimate. So, a late February due date, Liz said. A snow baby.